While being on the cutting edge of scientific and nutritional research, Biomedical Research Labs has developed the number one selling equine blood builder in the world, the most advanced muscle builder and tie-up preventer, and now the best anti-bleeding paste ever made. To find out how EPO Equine Unlock and Bleeder Guard can help your equine athletes, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880 and visit brlscience.com.
Porchbills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 938-4643.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races, and I think I've had Alan Foreman as much as anybody over the 10-plus years, and I think one other time live, I think at Symposium.
At Symposium. In
right?
Tucson. That's right.
That's what I thought. Okay. So not, the, not yeah. the first time that we've done a face-to-face.
And I also did Saratoga. You had me on in Saratoga.
Oh, for probably you were up for Roundtable, probably.
I was up for Roundtable, and you saw me walking by. And you say, come on over here, and you put the headphones on, and we chatted.
I put the tack on anybody that is within reach, and some escape, some get away.
And it's great fun because people stop to watch you. So it's a very entertaining experience.
Well, it's always fun. Our conversations that are so diverse because of you. I mean, your background and your involvement in the industry, and we've talked about it. I've asked you before, but the various Alan Foreman hats, and you brought a Match Series hat, and this story all by itself is really, really encouraging, especially in light of the opinions that manifest themselves on the internet, particularly that the industry can't cooperate and that there's nothing ever gets done. Well, except when it does, like bringing the Match Series back.
You know, it was 21 years ago that we premiered the Match Series, and the industry was in a different place back then. Different track ownerships. There was more money in the business. There was more focus on marketing. And then when the series ended in 2002, I didn't think it would come back. There were just too many issues. The industry was changing. The region experienced great difficulties. Delaware, you know, got slots. Monmouth was privatized by the Christie administration. Maryland had its difficulties when the Stronach Group took over and then partnered with Penn Gaming, and it looked like Maryland Racing was on the verge of collapse. I mean, you could go from track to track and find problems, and just circumstances converged this time. The industry in the Mid-Atlantic, and I think it's important for people to understand, the largest concentration of racing on a daily basis in the United States is in the Mid-Atlantic region. Mid-Atlantic represents 40% of the national handle. And you have horsemen who are racing throughout this region. They're going right up 95 or Route 1 or whatever. There can be as many as 11 tracks operating at the same time during the summer and competing for the same horse population, which has been shrinking. And this industry focus on uniformity probably makes more sense in the Mid-Atlantic region than anywhere else in the country. And the horsemen want uniformity. And so that led us, and I've been facilitating meetings of the regulators in the region for more than 20 years. We started to bring the horsemen's groups into the meetings. Then we brought the tracks into the meetings. And 5 years ago, we realized that collectively we needed to really deal with uniformity from the standpoint of integrity, the safety and welfare of the horse and rider, and the best interest of the industry. And so we started working in a collaborative fashion, and we've been so successful with it. It occurred to me last year that, you know, I think maybe we're at a point where we can try to transfer this to the racing side and the marketing side. And so we started talking to, I started talking to our partners in the region, and they all lit up when I suggested the possibility of bringing Match back. We met in October, more than 40 representatives of the tracks, the horsemen's groups, the breeders, regulators showed up to the meeting. The track said, well, if you can get the horsemen to put up the bonus money, we'll consider putting up the money for administration and marketing. The horsemen put the bonus pool together. We went to the tracks. They agreed to do it. And then we put the racing directors together and said, now you put your agendas aside. We all know we're competing with each other, but come on in the room here and let's design a series and let's see if we can make it work. And it was an amazing experience to watch them in action and designing divisions and moving races and recognizing that each track has its own big event day and agreeing not to run races against Match Series races so that in the divisions that we've created, it's a roadmap for the horsemen who have horses eligible in that division. There's nowhere else they can go. So it all came together. Then the breeders who we invited into the series came to us last month and said, we'd like to participate. And they put some money into a bonus pool to reward breeders in the region. So we've got the breeders involved. So everybody who has a skin in the game in this region is a partner in the Match Series.
And the best part of it, beyond the obvious and the benefits for the horsemen and owners that have a schedule and they have targets that are laid out, the continuity and the interest level for horse players and casual fans who can anticipate, you know, these spots and know, you know, ideally if the horses are all, you know, if they're obviously there's going to be horses that are going to get sidetracked or going to have issues that can't participate the way you'd ideally like and be able to, you know, run in enough of these that they hit the board in the bonus program. But it does provide a continuity element that is really missing other than with Triple Crown and the Triple Crown lead up. There's been so many attempts by the industry to capitalize on that organic success. Breeders' Cup continues to try to do the same thing with their Challenge Series and the Win and You're In program to, you know, to build off of that familiarity. And it's just a win. It's a winner every from every angle.
Well, it gives the horsemen in the region the opportunity to experience a big event. The horsemen who really, the owners, the trainers who support racing in this region on a day-to-day basis, most of them don't get to experience Triple Crown. They don't get to experience Breeders' Cup.
That's a great point.
You've got Maryland Million Day. So we've created an event for them that they can, it's a league that we've created essentially in five different divisions. And it gives them interest. It gets them invested in this event. I think it's going to be fun for them. It's going to be fun to watch the competition. There's a lot of money at stake, and I think they're going to have a good time. I know this will work because it worked the last time we did it. It was very successful and very popular, and but for inside industry politics, I think it probably would have continued for quite some time. So I'm optimistic that we'll be able to do it again.
As we explained with our prior visit when this was announced, and we'll track every portion of it, five different divisions, and the action starts this weekend right here, starts Friday with the Ski Pat here at Pimlico. Monmouth is going to be involved, and they come up pretty quickly as well with the Salvatore Mile next week. Parks, Presque Isle, Delaware, Laurel, of course, when the scene shifts, and the entire Mid-Atlantic a part of this, and that means that all the different entities, THAs, HPPAs, agglomerating. You talked about the breeders and you know, virtually everybody, and I suppose when Colonial for next year, there's room for Colonial to get involved.
Sure. I mean, I've already been asked about next year, and I'd love to get through this year and see if everybody is satisfied that we were smart in bringing this thing back. We talked about New York when we last did the series, and I've gotten some inquiries from New York. Why didn't you include us in the discussions? We would love to have included Charlestown again this time. West Virginia has its issues that they're still working through with purse money and money for the industry. And now Colonial's back in the picture. And, you know, we successfully ran it at Colonial when we last had the series. So there's plenty of opportunities. There's lots of ideas of things we'd like to do, but we've got to make it work this time first. And I think people, those who are participating, want to get their feet wet and just get a sense of whether we were smart to bring it back. We'll do a post-mortem at the end of the series, and we'll see what everybody thinks. And if it's what I'm hoping it will be, we'll be back.
Phillies and Mares and males on the turf, two divisions there. There's the sprinting on the dirt for Phillies and Mares and the boys, and then there's a long dirt division. So five divisions to start. Can Phillies move in between?
No, you have to stay
in your own
division.
Okay.
Right? You don't accumulate points running in more than one division. It's within the division. You win your division, and then you accumulate points within that division, and the top earning horse wins for the owner and wins for the trainer the overall bonuses. What's interesting about the schedule is that we didn't select divisions that would have been the obvious divisions that would have guaranteed large fields, because that didn't guarantee the tracks would be able to move races, would be able to sequence the races, that we would eliminate competition. And I give Mike Dempsey at Monmouth a lot of credit for this. He said, you know, you ought to select divisions that we're all either struggling with or we are so in competition with each other that we're running smaller fields, and let's try to build up those divisions. So that's how we got to the divisions that we're running this time. And, obviously hopeful that we'll have large fields. The Ski Pet came up a little light, more lighter than I would have expected, and that's because New York ran a sprint last week. But nonetheless, we'll watch as the series goes. We've got a couple monster horses already running this weekend. I would have expected that because it's Preakness weekend and you got trainers coming in from out of the region. Maybe they'll leave their horses in the series. But we'll start to get a sense of things once we leave Pimlico and we get out into the region and see how well it's being embraced and how well our sequencing worked.
And it's both the combination of graded stakes that have got long histories, the DeFrancis Dash and the Maryland Sprint this weekend, actually. The DeFrancis, of course, at the end of the season in September. Things start this weekend. It concludes mid-September at Laurel, in fact, as we wind down. But virtually every... You know, every area is covered when you look at, you know, the Parks Dash is a grade three, the Islin and the Salvatore Mile and the Monmouth Cup are all grade threes. So there's a half a dozen graded stakes. But then there's things like the Jim McKay, the Turf Sprint on Friday, looking around the Hokesson later at Delaware. And, you know, I am reminded, you know, thinking about cooperation and I think about Sal Sinatra, who authored the 60-minute pick six, which was one of the greatest multi-track, multi-race wagers. Everybody talks about the Magna 5, which was fun and was an in-house Magna idea, but Sal was able to put together this unbelievable pick six that was, you know, basically run within an hour and 20 minutes, six races, and it lasted a season, but it, you know, that also had the high stakes in terms of working together and creating, I mean, the scheduling for it. That was a magic act. So certainly Sal and Georgian, the people that were involved in that, New York was involved in that as well.
Well, Sal and Georgian were my starting point, because I know if they're enthused about it, it's got a shot. And Sal's amazing. Georgian's amazing. And Sal worked with us when we last ran the series, so he was very familiar with it. And actually, it was Sal's idea that Championship Weekend, which is both at Laurel and Presque Isle, they run on a Saturday, Sunday. We're going to do a pick five, and we'll announce that as the series goes. And the participants in the series are all going to revenue share the money that we generate.
Oh, nice.
So another way to be cooperative, make sure, and let some of those who are investing in the series to get some money back.
Awesome. Just
another way to promote the series, and I'm just really excited that
that's great.
The track cooperation on this has been spectacular.
Well, the betting public, we love, for whatever reason, multi-track, multi-race wagers just motivate people. And you think back to the NTRA Pick Four, and whenever there's been, NYRA's been authoring as part of their television coverage, they've been doing these cross-country Pick Fours. the public eats these up. The Magna 5 and the 60 Minute 6 were absolute favorites, and we publicized them, and we handicapped and played them. Hit one Magna 5. And
we're going to lower the takeout. So
there you go.
It's going to be very attractive. I mean, it's all doing the right things.
Well, and we're going to talk about doing some other right things, but Match Series, matchseries.com has got all the details. I discussed it with you originally. How much can owners and the trainers, what's the bonus structure for them?
We've got a bonus pool for the owners and trainers of $450,000, and then the breeders have put in $40,000. In each of the divisions, the winning owner wins $20,000, the second place points earner $15,000, and the third place point earner $10,000, and then the trainer of the winners in each division, $15,000, $10,000, and $5,000. Then the overall winner of the series gets $50,000, and the trainer gets $25,000.
That's tremendous.
A little bit less than what we did the last time, but we were in a different
world last time.
It's a starting point.
It's got to start somewhere.
And then the breeders, each of the Bred Fund programs have put up $10,000 each, so the top filly mare, Colt Gelding, will each, for the breeder of the winning horse, get $5,000. So just to, you know, get the breeders participating, and I think if everybody's comfortable, this is going to grow much larger moving forward.
Unbelievable, outstanding, and I just got a text from Hammer. Rick says he was there
Rick
at the beginning, and he says hello.
Rick, he was a tremendous supporter. He's a good friend. He loved the series, and it's nice to hear from him.
Let's take this as a starting point for some other conversations regionally, and I'm not letting you get away without, you know, some historic perspective here at Pimlico and the future. But this has been a as always, people, it's funny, people say, Alan, how do you talk about racing 3 hours a day, 5 days a week? Well, when you have a week like you've got here with you know, the jockeys with torchlights and pitchforks, and and you got the Supreme Court, you got Dennis Drazen single-handedly changing the social landscape and the future.
And I can't, you know, Dennis is a very dear friend of mine, and I give Dennis and my colleagues at the New Jersey Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association, because they have been on edge for you. Their survival has basically been because of the partnership between Dennis and the New Jersey Horsemen. And they took on this issue. They're the plaintiffs in the case. You don't read that anywhere, but this case started their challenge.
You've heard it here for 6 years.
Exactly. But you don't read it in the
media. When Christie's name was soldered to it, I wanted to throw up.
But for Dennis and the New Jersey Horsemen, we wouldn't be where we are today. Yep. This wouldn't have happened, and they dogged it because they lost on two occasions, and they could have walked away from it. And I think the sense was, well, the Supreme Court's never going to take the case. And then if they take the case, there's no way they're going to take the leagues on. And it's an absolutely amazing story for them. And I couldn't be happier for them, because it's certainly going to put them in a far better position going forward to keep racing at Monmouth Park, which is so important to the industry.
Well, and when Dennis yesterday, you know, we spent 40 minutes yesterday, and the, you know, the first thing that he talked about wasn't even Monmouth's survival and what it is potentially going to do for an ailing industry, casino-wise, in Atlantic City. He talked about the Meadowlands as well, and expanding the Meadowlands meet. But the first thing he talked about was New Jersey breeding. And that, you know, that was the first thing, the green space, the farms, the ailing New Jersey. I mean, that Isabel de Tomaso has single-handedly kept alive, seemingly. But there's, you know, there's that portion of it. I sent out an article from the Daily Herald in Chicagoland this morning. Illinois, this could be a huge shot in the arm for Illinois in the same fashion. From your perspective, Alan, and the two regional players right now, Jersey obviously well positioned to start within weeks by the end of the month, but Delaware was a grandfathered state, right, along with Oregon and I think Montana. They were grandfathered with Vegas and have the sports parlay cards that I think people aren't even aware of, because Delaware is, you know, Delaware is like a speck. But the Delaware Park can benefit from this too.
Certainly can benefit from it. They've had limited sports wagering on the NFL games, and it's been modestly successful. Delaware is going to be able to move quickly. Pennsylvania, I believe, is going to be able
their
to
position.
Move quickly.
Although they've got the same problem that dogs. Parks, this odious, idiotic takeout structure that is just is inexplicable, that you could have this kind of revenue coming from the casino for this period of time, and yet they're still maintaining this crazy 30% takeout on multi-horse and multi-race wagers. It's embarrassing, actually.
Well, I actually think that's going to be the problem for every state that tries to get into the sports betting business.
They think they're going to glom?
And to me, I don't believe that it's going to be a big revenue generator for racing. It's an opportunity for racing. Racing has suffered for decades now. It started with the lotteries, then it was casino gaming. It's been any form of competition for the gambling dollar, because prior to the advent of the lotteries, we were the only legalized form of wagering in the United States, unless you went to Las Vegas. So, to me, it's not the dollars, because I think it's going to be incremental and probably small. But you need to get people into your facility. You need to upgrade your facilities. You want them there. I think they'll cross-pollinate. They'll cross-bet. Doesn't happen with slots as much. That's the opportunity to get people into your building or to get into your ADW pools or whatever. Other than that, this is going to be a very complicated issue. Number one, trying to figure out how to spread the money around among the various interests, which always happens. You've got the leagues that are going to step in and seek integrity fees, such as you see in New York. They're going to want a piece of the action, claiming that you're using their product. You're using their product for your benefit. Therefore, they want to be compensated for it. Sounds like horse racing. It's going to be and then there's a possibility the federal government will step in and try to take over the regulation of sports betting. I think given the current dynamic in Washington, that's unlikely. But the Supreme Court made very clear that there is an avenue for the federal government. If it wants to take over the regulation of sports betting, they can do it on a national basis.
Well, and Orrin Hatch, swung into action. And he, of course, was the author of PASPA going back to the early 90s, and is the guy that seems offended. You would think there'd be bigger concerns for him with him retiring. It'd be nice if he just faded into obscurity without any more noise. The lead story in the USA Today today and with Gannett nationwide was the unlikelihood that a federal mandate would be able to to come together. And it was really, and you can speak to this also as an attorney, and I can use this as an avenue toward a further discussion, the anti-commandeering principle that girded Dennis Drazen to begin with. Wouldn't this result also preclude that the concept of the USADA, doesn't it render that moot?
Well, not necessarily, but I've certainly looked at that very issue, and I think that's what we're all looking at. And I've felt since the beginning of the Bartanko and previous iterations of Bartanko that the legislation is unconstitutional. And even if I'm wrong, I can assure you that there are a number of states that would challenge any attempt by the federal government to regulate in the medication area or supplant state-sanctioned, state-regulated business. So I think that's a given. We've been looking at the Supreme Court opinion here to see whether, in fact, it does render moot the effort to get federal legislation to regulate medication. And the court seemed to indicate that if the federal government wants to regulate and completely regulate, it has the ability to do so. Otherwise, if it fails to do so, it's left to the states. And I think you have this whole states' rights argument now. I think it's very prevalent among the Republicans, and which makes federal regulation of medication a much taller order. The only involvement that the federal government has in racing right now is the Interstate Horse Racing Act, which is the holy grail of horse racing. But with respect to the Interstate Horse Racing Act, the federal government doesn't regulate it. The federal government says if you want to do it, there are consents that are required, and the states go through whatever their mechanisms are in getting the consents, and if those consents are given, you can do it. That's far different than what the Bartanko bill does or any iterations of that does. And I'm fairly certain there are a number of attorneys generals from states who are opposed to looking to the federal government who will move to challenge any successful effort in Washington to regulate in the medication area. Now, for those who favor the regulation of medication, we're making and we've made incredible progress. And I've been around 40 years. This is the most incredible change in 40 years, what's been going on over the last 5 years, both with respect to the regulation of medication in the industry and the safety and welfare of the horse. And we are working on issues that I think everybody is concerned about going forward. And we're addressing those and trying to do that in a way that works within the existing system rather than blowing up what we have and trying to start over again or give it to people who don't know anything about our business and who threaten, many of us think threaten the way we're operating and aren't going to, you know, just don't want that involvement.
To that end and to that reference, what has been the motivation from your perspective of the carpet bombing concept that seems to emanate when it comes to, if you want to talk about the medication and what was involved, the anti-Lasix movement, the broad brushing and as I've said for ages, and you and I have broached this before, the painting with a broad brush of the horseman as drug addled and so forth. I mean, it served to me. It all it did was perpetuate negative imagery and myths that make it hard to make any progress acknowledged, more or less. I mean, the and granted, it's incremental and small victories, and whether it's RMTC work that we've talked about for years, I just bristle whenever there's those missives that paint everybody with a taint, basically.
Well, it's been a one-sided debate, and that's because those of us who have been working towards progress and working towards greater uniformity, and I have to tell you that this is a very uniform industry. The regulation of medication and health and welfare in the United States is far more uniform than what you hear from those who would argue that we're not uniform. And what we've done over the last 5 years is make it much better and to address the concerns that people had 5 years ago or 6 years ago when the push to eliminate Lasix became the most divisive issue in the industry. So I reject those who would argue that we have failed, that we are not uniform, that the industry is failing because we are not uniform. I really think that that's not accurate. It's not true. But we haven't engaged the debate publicly because that's not in the industry's best interest. But also, I mean, you use the word carpet bombing, but I think the constant drumbeat of the negative about the industry is not good and has not been good and healthy for our business. And, they talk about, well, we should operate like the NFL or the NBA, or what league office would allow the kind of negative attacks on the image of a sport that has been ongoing here? And so I'm disappointed by it, and we continue to move forward with, and there'll be other times to talk about that, and you know it, Steve, the kinds of reforms and things that we have enacted. It's in the areas where states have discretion where people might complain right now, but the facts belie the arguments that are being made, and it's disappointing. I'm going to continue to defend the industry. I'm going to do it with my head up. I think we are far better than any other sport in the world. Our drug testing, our treatment of our animals, the integrity of our sport. I'm not the least bit hesitant to defend it and to. But I have friends. I've got friends on the other side. This is not a personal issue, and I disagree with them. But I would rather work with them to attack those things that concern them the most, and see if we can't solve that within our own system rather than looking to the federal government. And at the end of the day, this whole debate started because it was about finding a mechanism to get rid of Lasix. It's all about that. And all these other issues that have been raised have been smoke screens to disguise that that is the issue, because everything else is either what we're doing right now or would change what we're doing in a way that would not benefit the industry in any way.
Now, and we, you know, we have seen successful implementation of things that have gone industry-wide, and I always point to the elimination of steroids from active use. We discovered fairly recently that there had been some attempts to skirt that and out of competition, and there's been a response even to that and a way to chase that down. I mean, there's plenty of examples of proactive and literally all 38 jurisdictions coming together, and the model rules, you know, we always keep reporting on the progress of the model rules adoption, and that includes in some jurisdictions that we thought would never adopt, like Florida and Louisiana, and you know, things like that. They take time, and okay, there's nobody that can sign a decree that makes it happen overnight, but we've seen one example after another of successful implementation in that direction.
The the new National Uniform Medication Program came out of the Mid-Atlantic. We had the Mid-Atlantic Uniform Medication and Drug Testing Program, and all of the Mid-Atlantic states participate. And every year we take a look to see how effective the program is. There were 50,000 drug tests of horses in the Mid-Atlantic in 2017. There were 175 positive tests, the bulk of which were for therapeutic medication overages. There were maybe three or four instances of substances that were doping substances. And that really tells the story. We've got a multiple medication violation system that we've implemented, is being implemented throughout the country. We didn't have a single trainer who served a multiple medication violation penalty in 2017, which shows that the new system, or the improved system, is working. And you're going to get occasional
issues. Well, I was just about to say, how do we resolve and mitigate, you know, the specific areas where where problems have arisen? You know, Bill Mott rightfully fighting the bizarre Lasix overage.
Actually, he had two overages. He had Flunixin and Lasix overages in the same sample, and the veterinarian who collected the sample didn't collect sufficient blood that after his A sample, the one that was tested at the New York laboratory, was tested, that there was any blood left if he wanted to have a referee sample done by another laboratory.
Then there's the case in Kentucky where Graham Motion continues to pursue and get that cleared up. There's examples where
the Rusty Arnold case,
whole thing was ridiculous. These crop up, and then Alan Fairley. I mean, there are people that point to specific seeming incidents or examples of, I mean, use the fair term, move up trainers and move up circumstances where the appearances of you know, magical results that get trotted out. And I mean, how do we either mollify or address that?
Well, I can tell you over the years, there have always been trainers who seem to move up for whatever reason, or they claim a horse from another trainer. It wasn't doing anything with the trainer who had the horse. All of a sudden, the horse is running away. Intelligence helps. And in racing, there's no lack of intelligence. And I don't mean brains, but I'm talking about word of mouth on the backstretch or otherwise. In most instances, those trainers are super tested. They're watched. There are any number of things that are done. Our laboratory system is as good as it gets. There's always the sense that there are substances being used that we can't find.
Right.
We try to chase it down. You would think through intelligence you can find it, but that isn't always hardly is ever the case. you're always going to have instances of somebody trying to get an edge. You'll never be able to eliminate that. The instances of that happening in racing are fewer and far between than ever before, but they're never going to go away. One of the things that I think we're collectively talking about, if you want to talk about what we need to do better in the industry, is our investigative arm. We used to have an organization called the Thoroughbred Racing Protective Bureau, and if you go back 30 years,
still do,
they were the FBI of horse
TRPB,
racing. TRPB?
Curtis Linnell and company?
But it's a different organization than it once was. Every track had a TRPB agent 30 years ago. And I remember, because when I was in the Attorney General's office here in Maryland, I met with the TRPB at least once a week because they had information about someone, or they were conducting an investigation, or they had received information about from source A or source B about this one or that one. We don't have that anymore. There's no the kind of intelligence gathering and exchange of information that we used to have. We need to go back to that. We need to recreate that. I know that security at some tracks is getting better. Here in Maryland, there are security cameras going into every stall. I think that's important. Boots on the ground is important. I think everybody agrees that we need to do a better job with intelligence. The federal bill isn't going to solve that one.
No.
So we need to do that ourselves, and I think there's a desire to do so. We need more money for research.
Well, that's an issue that has become very apparent. And that includes the funding from states that have been shy about appropriating the right amount of money to their gaming commissions to enforce and to enhance and to raise the bar when it comes to that portion of it.
Actually, the single biggest issue in horse racing right now, from a medication perspective, is a drug called they're called bisphosphonates. Tildren or Osfos. The public may be able to relate to that. Postmenopausal women who have osteoporosis are now being given these kinds of drugs because they rebuild the bone. They're being given to our babies. They're being given by breeders, make the horses look better for the sales. They look better on the x-rays. And it's really scandalous at this point. We're looking to determine, is that a racing problem or a breeding problem? But it's the number one problem. We're devoting money towards it. We need more money for that research. And besides designer drugs, this is a very significant problem because of the possibility that if we're doing this with young horses and they get to the racetrack, the breakdown and fatality rate may grow. So we have to be extraordinarily vigilant about that. I believe that we need to devote significant dollars, and we've talked about this for the last few years, and it just seems to fall off. We're not going to solve this Lasix debate by trying to force horses off of Lasix or phasing it out, because you have to phase it out in the breeding shed, because they come from the breeders, they're bleeders. It's in the breed. We need to find alternative medications or alternative therapies. That takes money. It takes interested the scientific community, the pharmaceutical companies. To me, that would be a tremendous priority if we could solve that problem, because it hangs over everything else. And then we look to the scientific community to talk to us and tell us, here are the emerging problems. We talk internationally. It isn't a national problem. It's an international problem. And we, whether it's the performance horse industry, the racing industry, this is a worldwide problem. And we talk about that, and we need to channel research dollars into that. And, to me, if the federal government could be helpful, it would be getting us grant money, federal dollars through the Department of Agriculture or otherwise, to help us do that. That would be an intelligent way to go to the federal government, not to come in here and just uproot what we're doing and try to tell us we're doing it wrong and let somebody else think that they're straightening out our industry.
Well, as I've said, don't make me say some things about that. I mean, an agency that is having that's had trouble, keeping track of a couple hundred boxers. They're supposed to keep track of tens of thousands of racehorses. Okay. Shift our attention back to Maryland specifically. Alan Foreman is with us, and we can throw any kind of pitch at Alan. Fastballs, screwballs, you name it. The situation here, and it's going to continue to come up, the the state and the city is continuing to research what the right thing to do with Pimlico is, both for the city and for the use of funds, as to whether Pimlico is going to get a refab or a complete rebuild. It does feel like the Stronach Group have cast their ballot at Laurel and the concept of phasing things out here. They would only commit last week to running the Preakness here next year. Alan, you've seen it all, including legislation in Annapolis to keep the to legislatively keep the Preakness in Baltimore County. Some thoughts about what is going to happen here over the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, you know, I grew up 10 minutes from here.
Did you Reisterdown Road?
In Lockhern.
Lockhern.
In fact, the county executive who you all learned who passed away very suddenly last week was my neighbor in Lockhern. And so Pimlico is a second home to me. I brought my children out here on Saturday mornings, and Jerry Bailey and Mike Smith and Pat Day and Chris McCarron would take them up into the jocks room. And so I have a great affinity for this place. I understand the Stronach Group's issues. They are with one revenue stream supporting two racetracks, one of which is in disrepair, total disrepair, and cannot be fixed. This facility cannot be, you can't do a Band-Aid. It has no foundation. So it needs to come down and something needs to go up. And the reason why it's important to them is because they can't grow the event here. Like they did at Churchill where they dropped down Sky Suites. And you can't do that here. So you have to start from the ground up and they can't grow the event. So that's why they're looking at making changes. And the kinds of changes here at Pimlico that need to be made are not something that any track owner can afford to do. I don't care who it is. There isn't enough revenue being generated. In fact, the Preakness revenues support Maryland racing for the entire year. So that starts the discussion. What do you do with Pimlico? It needs, it's falling apart. You've been here over the years, Steve. You know the problems. The good thing is they got a referee to kind of get in the middle and try to keep this debate honest. And so we got the Maryland Stadium Authority, which built Camden Yards and built Ravens Stadium and has done so many other great things, to come in and do an independent analysis, not someone hired by Maryland Jockey Club or hired by someone else. They work for the state, and they've done phase one, and they're working on phase two, which will come out at the end of the year. And quite frankly, it makes sense. This is an election year, and nobody wanted to get into a political football. So once we have a new we have a gubernatorial election. I don't know whether we'll have a new governor or not. Governor Hogan has been tremendously supportive of the industry. He'll have a challenger. We'll see what happens. We've been fortunate over the years that all of the administrations support racing because racing is so important to the state of Maryland. But their second part of the analysis, which is what you can do here, what are the alternatives, will help to frame this debate next year. But trust me, this isn't going to get resolved by next year, maybe even the next 2 years. The problem here is, what do you do with this property? Does it make sense to put $300 million into a new facility, $300 to $500 million for what is now 7 days of racing, 10 days of racing, or a short meet? I don't think that there's any intention to run a longer meet here. How do you make the property worthwhile the rest of the year? We've got a major hospital over on the over on the other corner, which would like to expand, but they don't want to be perceived as having put Pimlico out of business. You've got some developers who have come in with ideas. My good friend Anthony Manganiello has a very dynamic idea for what to do with the property, but that's something he's going to have to negotiate through the Stronach Group and the state and the city. There are others who have ideas. I'm somewhat pessimistic. I know this area, and I know that up to a certain point, redevelopment makes sense. But as you go from this property to the Inner Harbor, it is it's not a safe place. There's a lot of crime. People will not go into that area. That needs to get fixed. The Park Heights corridor needs to get fixed. And without some plan to do that, I'm skeptical about year-round development here and how successful it will be. There's the crime issue. mean, you know, when they built racetracks 80, 60, 70, 80 years ago, these were where you would put it. In today's world, you wouldn't put a racetrack in this corridor.
No, and of course, this facility.
Belmont, or you go around the country, you can look at locations and say, well, why did you put it here?
Well, this was the outskirts in 1830. It was these were all the outskirts, and then the city grew up around it. You bring up a point, and we think back to just the awful scenes here, and even before I got onto the media side of racing, I was coming to Preaknesses. I talked about. Last week about my food business career and I'd come here to meet with Martin Gillette in the Inner Harbor and Jerry Butchke and they would take me to Hausner's. And I can say that I used to go to a Bricky's when it was on Pratt Street. And to drive around, Alan, is really disheartening. I called on the kosher grocery store when I was selling for Old Fashioned Kitchen on Reisterstown Road to the kosher market there, and I'm staying in Catonsville the last 3-4 years, and it's hard to drive through here.
And the situation has worsened since the Freddie Gray nightmare. I actually drove through there a few days ago. I hadn't done it in a while, and they are tearing down some of the dilapidated houses, but there still is no plan. It's still, you know, you wouldn't recommend that people go through there. And I hate to say that. This is my hometown, and I'm not trying to denigrate the city of Baltimore, but it's a serious, serious concern. And then, you know, you take all of that, and then you think about the tradition of the race, the tradition of the sport, and there are those who say you can't move it. You cannot disturb that tradition. And then there's the local horsemen who said, well, you can't race at just one facility year-round. You'll just run that into the ground, and we need to have another place to go, and we've always had two places.
We can see the challenge that it's posed in California, where it's as wonderful as Santa Anita is, it is grueling to not get a freshening, and, you know, thank God for Los Al and of course, Del Mar, but these ongoing extended periods at one facility, it makes the turf, it's tough on the turf courses, and you see what's going on at Gulfstream. I mean, it's ridiculous.
But I have to tell you, if you didn't have the Stronach Group, they're the only ownership group in the country. God bless Frank Stronach. The only ownership group in the country who are putting dollars into bricks and mortar, in addition to everything else. What they're doing at Laurel is staggering, quite frankly. I don't know anybody else who would do that. And you don't see it anywhere else in the United States. And so it's a really complicated issue. It's a complicated political issue. I guarantee you, if there's any effort to move the Preakness to Laurel, the Baltimore Sun and the City Fathers and a number of the politicians are going to go crazy. It's going to be a very difficult and heavy lift in the legislature, and it's going to require a plan for this property, if in fact that's going to happen, that works for everyone.
And that ideally would spread, a positive, trickle down and into the neighborhoods that surround. I will
I'm
roll
skeptical.
With the,
I live here and I'm an optimist, but I'm on this one. I'm very skeptical as to what's going to happen.
Last year we watched as Seth Klarman, who grew up two blocks away.
And, you know, when I started in the business here in the late 70s, we had Laurel, Pimlico, and Bowie, all under separate ownership. Hmm. And we got to the early 80s, and the industry had changed, and everyone said, that's killing the business. You've got to consolidate under one ownership. Each individual ownership just can't make it. And, of course, the industry was changing from the standpoint of, you know, we hadn't started account wagering yet, but we were starting simulcasting, and the whole economic engine of the industry was changing. And so Frank DeFrancis comes in, and he consolidates. He closes Bowie. He takes over ownership of Laurel and Pimlico, and now we're under one ownership, and we've been under one ownership since that time. Now, Frank had owned a harness track, and then he bought Laurel, and then he bought Pimlico from the Cohen brothers. Now there are those who say, you know, the biggest mistake we made was consolidating under one ownership. So, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And but quite frankly, I don't know where we would be right now if Frank Stronach had not committed to Maryland. And he had his hiccups. You know, Frank and I weren't speaking 5-6 years ago when Maryland was about to close. I mean, he blamed me for half of what was going on.
Well, when he missed that $26 million payment to the state to be able to be eligible for the gaming license, the assumption was this is a death knell. Then, in fact, the way things ended up, getting the stipend has proven to be maybe even I'm sure they don't feel this way. I'm sure they'd love to have the gaming and own the license instead of what happened at Maryland Live, but the Cordish companies. But at the same time, the stipend has been wonderful. It hasn't been an avalanche of money, but having just a steady flow, it girded the game, breeding, and you can see how healthy everything is. It's amazing.
But it takes an owner who is committed to the business and who's willing to commit his own dollars to make it happen. Yeah. Nobody else would have done that. And Frank said, and they continue to say, we don't need gaming at our tracks to survive. It's a crutch. And he was willing to put his dollars behind it. They've taken the incremental monies they get from what we call the RFRA program to make capital improvements. And yes, most of that money's going into Laurel because Laurel is between Baltimore and Washington. They see that as a place where they can grow their business.
Yeah.
They can't grow it here at Pimlico, so why wouldn't they do that? No Band-Aids here. The renaissance here has been unbelievable. He had partnered up with Penn Gaming. They had this crazy idea that by partnering up, they were going to get the state to reverse its position on where the casinos go. It was a disaster. They came in with a proposal to run 40 days of live racing. The horsemen said, you know, no way, we'll see the place closed before we do that. And in fact, they did lock the gates. And the Racing Commission stepped in and said, we're not going to grant a license. The governor got us all down in his office and said, you all fix this. We ended up with a 10-year agreement, and we all have skin in the game. The horsemen are revenue sharing with Frank. We give Frank $5 million a year, and we've grown the program from what was originally 100 days now to 167 racing days, and it's going to continue to grow. And that money does not come from slot money. The horsemen are committing their share of simulcasting money, handle money, and otherwise. But it's an investment because we're partners with the Stronach Group. And so we've been able to build new OTBs.
Well, the Timonium OTB is a mammoth success.
And we're doing it creatively. The old 50-50, you know, we're only going to give you 50% instead of them coming and saying, look, we'll build the place, give us 70% of the revenue, we'll give you 30%, but we'll grow that. It's been a fabulous success, and we've been able to do so much here. And look, we still have growing pains. We still have problems. I don't want everybody to think that it's Shangri-La here. When we didn't have money, we fought, and we have money and we fight. But we keep those fights behind closed doors. We work completely together. We all go behind closed doors. There's a unity of purpose here. The legislature just loves when we come down during the session and tell the good stories. So we've built a success story here, and I think that Maryland's future is very much solidified. Assuming the Stronach Group stays in the game with us.
Well,
and that's Belinda, who is, as you know, is becoming
more and more
involved. And this place is spectacular. You should see what she's doing out in the infield.
Yeah, with taking advantage of
entertainment. And Belinda's been terrific to work with, and there's nobody better than – I love Tim Ritvell. I've worked closely with him over the years, and Sal Sinatra and Georgie Ann. We've had P.J. Campo coming in doing some work with us, who's working with Frank. And we feel very fortunate here, and I hope we can translate what we're doing here to other places. I mean, I look at Illinois, and I see the way they're all fighting, and it's just you can't move forward unless you all are pulling in the same direction.
Well, Maryland for many years, and you mentioned the political. You think about Governor Schaefer, and you know, I get to do the show from here every year, and I've got the incredible archives that I put out these pictures, and I'll send out a bunch later today as we wait for the 5 o'clock draw, and the relationship between the state government, the city administration, and this, particularly this facility. You talk about Maryland history. You fold in Bel Air and Havre de Grace and Cumberland, and at one time there, I think there were 11 racetracks operating over the course of a year in Maryland. And Maryland, we always remind people, when there was the gambling blackout in 1908 to 1910, there were only two states in the country that continued to have racing: Maryland and Kentucky. And if it wasn't for Maryland, racing would have gone dark on the East Coast completely. And much like we say, certain franchises are vital. I mean, a healthy New York, a healthy Naira is imperative. A healthy Maryland was absolutely imperative. And much like the conversations I had for 6 years, Alan, with Dennis Drazen, as he fought for what turned out to be a successful overturning of PASPA, you and I soldiered through a very difficult period as well when it came to Maryland. I do want to hearken back and round this conversation out. You mentioned the Cohn brothers. You look at so many of these pictures that I get to enjoy, the post-war era at Pimlico, and Lou Ponfield and the Cohens, Herman and Ben Cohen, then Chick Lang, coming in there. Luckily for people there, there's a number of, particularly the Barry Levinson films, the troika of Diner, Tin Men, and Avalon, that virtually any period piece about Baltimore has Pimlico reference and Pimlico and scenes and backdrop, and the characters here. Not that there aren't characters everywhere, but there was a verve here, and there still is an everlasting light that is still lamp, that is still lit. But talk about growing up in that era, and I there was a uniquely Hamish tinge to what went on here.
Barry Levinson and the Diner guys didn't grow up in Loch Hearn. They grew up in the Pimlico area, and I knew all of them. I played golf with Barry's father over the years. And just amazing how things come around. When he did Liberty Heights, which was the second of his trilogy, my sister lives just up the road here off of Park Heights. And one day, Barry knocked on her door. She answered. She didn't know who he was. And he said, "Hi, I'm Barry Levinson. I'd like to use your house for my movie."
Not for siding? He wasn't trying to sell her the aluminum siding?
So the doctor in the movie, the black doctor, those scenes were filmed in my sister's house.
Oh, my God.
So this is a very small town. But, racing was iconic here. When I went to high school, a lot of guys would sneak off after, the seventh period, sixth period, and run over here and, walk in and go over to Pimlico. Saturdays were legend here. I mean, everybody dressed up. You went to the dining room, or you're going to Pimlico. The Pimlico meet was a rite of spring. And Chick Lang made it even more so. And he was a really iconic character. But Joe Hirsch used to come. I used to have lunch with Joe Hirsch. And just so many of the old figures. The Pimlico Hotel was right up here on the corner where everybody hung out. I remember meeting Rodney Dangerfield out on the parking lot one night. He had come into town for the races and did a show at night. And as I said, I used to bring my kids out here on Saturday mornings, and they would get together with the jocks and go up to the jocks' room. And it was just great. And I got lucky because I was actually with a law firm that represented Pimlico. And we had a new attorney general. We had a governor who had gone to federal prison in a racetrack scandal here.
Most governors from Maryland go to jail.
But it was a racetrack scandal. And I got an offer to go to the new attorney general and work for him. And the first question he asked me was, "What do you know about horse racing?" And so I went in. Among my clients in state government was the Maryland Racing Commission. And lo and behold, the 1980 Preakness Genuine Risk and Codex becomes a national story. And I thought the attorney general would want to be involved and get all the limelight publicity. And he said, "They're your client. you represent them, but I want you to represent the stewards. I don't want you to represent the commission. And so I represented the stewards in the case, and that was my – that opened up my career. And it just was one of those seminal moments in my career, and I'll never forget it. And people still talk about it today, and it's the one Preakness, obviously, I'll remember. But I remember Deputa testimony winning in the pouring down rain here in 1983, affirmed Elidor, Sunday Silence, American Pharaoh, Fusiachi Pegasus. I mean, I could go on and on to the great horses that raced here, and that been happy to be, to just see these horses, go back in the barn and talk to the trainers and get to know them. And, you know, I've known Wayne Lucas now. Codex was Wayne Lucas's first Triple Crown win.
We lost Leroy Jolly, and we had a conversation with Leroy, and I've actually put up pictures from the hearing either last year or the year before. And it's one of those things that Leroy, a guy that you could understand, didn't suffer fools lightly, and I suppose could hold a grudge or would keep things inside of him, and that bothered him the rest of his life.
It was a surreal experience. It's one of the few Preaknesses I've missed. I had gotten food poisoning the night before at the Preakness party. And so I was home watching it on television so I could see what was going on that you wouldn't have known at the racetrack. So when Fred Caldwell, who was the state steward, went on the roof where we are right now with ABC, and they asked him, you know, what the stewards had seen. And after 20 minutes of, well, there's a bump and this horse is going to come down. That was Billy Hartack and Howard Cosell saying the horse is going to come down, and Fred Caldwell saying, well, we didn't see a bump, we didn't see any contact. No wonder the public was outraged, because he didn't see what ABC was seeing. He saw his steward's shots. But what was incredible about that case was that there was a Baltimore Sun photographer at the turn right where the incident happened who knew nothing about horse racing, but whose job was just to take pictures all day. And I guess four or five days before the hearing, the attorneys for the Genuine Risk folks, the Binger family, brought us some still photographs that they said they were going to use in the hearing, and we didn't know why. But on the back of the photographs was the stamp of the photographer from the Baltimore Sun, and so we called him, asked him if he had any other film. We got his film, and lo and behold, he had shots of the horses coming around the turn. And so we got a hold of the ABC broadcast, and we compared them to the photos, and what we realized was that the pan shots from the roof that these ABC was using distort what you actually see. You see instant replay now. You can count the nose hairs on the players, actually. Well, back then it was all a blur, and it looked like the two horses were just absolutely on top of each other. And then when you got the actual photograph of them coming around the turn, they weren't close at all. And I've got, it still hangs in my office today, a plaque that has those photographs. And there's so many stories from that those 2 weeks that it's just unbelievable. Maybe one day I'll write a book.
Well, there's plenty of material, and the stories that whether they're on the track or on the other side here, and one of the great, I promised this earlier because I've been spending time both stops so far in Triple Crown, looking at the races on the days leading up, May 16th, 2009, Rachel Alexandra, and a performance that just was the start of one of the most amazing campaigns in the history of thoroughbred racing, and a great, contribution to the lore of the Preakness. And we're going to listen to it as we wrap up with Alan Foreman. And as always, Alan, I think we hit on most of your areas of interest, expertise, and practice. As always, I'm infinitely appreciative of all the time we get to spend.
Well, thank you, and I want everybody to know that Steve has partnered with us to help market the series. We appreciate what you're doing for us and what you're going to do, and I appreciate what you do for the industry, quite frankly. I don't think you get the recognition that you deserve for helping to promote the industry on a daily basis, and one day that recognition will come.
Well,
I promise you.
The reward is all the people that enjoy the game, that have come to become involved in it, players and development of players, and keeping stakeholders and anybody interested in the game, keeping them in tune with the ebbs and flows of the sport. And if you get involved in it, you'll be rewarded. It's as welcoming an industry. I don't want to confine it to a sport, because there's so many different ways to get involved, and you're involved in so many portions of it. And without the dedication that people like you and people like you, we couldn't advance anything. So thanks to Alan Foreman, as always, for his extended visit. I appreciate it.
Thank you,
Alan Foreman. We're going to listen right here to Tom Durkin's call of Rachel Alexandra. And Tom had the unique pleasure, obviously, when she would come to New York and win the Woodward. Lives in history. Let's listen. And when we come back, Seth Merrow is going to join us to close out this busy Wednesday at the races. Rachel's Preakness, Tom Durkin.
Ready for the start. And they're off in the Preakness. McDrama gets off to a good start. Huskin Man is there too. Here's Rachel Alexandra on the far outside, Pioneer of the Nile. And Friesen Fire has some early speed too. So they pass by us for the first time. And Velasquez is taking Big Drama well out into the track. Farthest out though, it is Rachel Alexandra. Taking a bit wide going into that first turn here. Friesen Fire is third. Pioneer of the Nile is fourth. Take the points. Is fifth on the outside as the filly gets loaded wide. Then Papa Clum was down sixth toward the rail. General Quarters is seventh and Musket Man is eighth. And then it's Tone It Down is winning ninth on the outside. A break of five back to Wayne Lucas's two runners. Flying Private and Love Dove. And they're followed by Terrain and Mind That Bird. The Derby winner, where he was in the Derby at this point, he is last. Now about 12 lengths from the lead. Strong enough is the pace for him to run into. It was a 46 3/2 mile. And the filly's in front. She's in front early on here. Rachel Alexandra narrowly. Big Drama still going to stay right with her all the way. Friesen Fire looms back in third position. Half mile to go in the Preakness. On the inside, Papa Clem runs along in for it. Far outside, Pioneer of the Nile. Now running in fifth. From the back of the pack, Mind That Bird. 13th, 12th, 11th, and he's 10th now. And there's 3 furlongs to go. Mind That Bird beginning to roll. Around the far turn here at Pimlico, Rachel Alexandra, the leader by 2 as the field turns for home. Big Drama running in second now. Mind That Bird looks for a way through, and he had to go way outside for it. Musket Man toward the inside. Rachel Alexandra's in front with 1 furlong to go. Musket Man moves to second. Mind That Bird is third on the outside. The filly trying to hold on. She's clear by 3. Mind That Bird runs at her late. Here's the winner. And the filly did it. Rachel Alexandra has defeated the Kentucky Derby winner. Mind That Bird by 3/4 of a length. Musket Man was third. The final time was 1:55 flat. A magnificent victory. An exquisite filly. And a thrill to see.
Well, that, of course, more or less a companion, I would say, especially the filly did it, because Durkin uses it later on. Rachel Alexandra the Great, and just an amazing performance. And we started the conversations this morning mentioning the wet track Derby winners, Mind That Bird. And Mind That Bird, he wins that race if there's no Rachel. He wins it, in fact, in a cakewalk. He absolutely would have won, and who knows what happens under that circumstance. Things change at Belmont. Maybe Calvin Burrell, maybe we could have gotten him to ride a couple of races at Belmont before Mind That Bird. That might have helped, because he didn't seem to when it came to the Belmont, he didn't really, I think, understand when to move. We're going to stay right here, and only about 6-7 minutes to close out the Wednesday. And I can't thank Alan Foreman enough for the extended visit. And, as I say, Alan, with so many areas of expertise, legal counsel to the Maryland Jockey Club. You've heard his background, and of course, you know, being native to the neighborhood and his work at RMTC and with so many of the auspices that manage the business of racing. Seth Merrow joins us, and we got to get Seth's opinions when it comes to Preakness on Saturday. Seth, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, fun conversation there with Alan Foreman talking about Maryland, which a few years ago we were worried about. Now it's kind of had a resurgence. And you had in the middle of that conversation, one of the things that I think gets overlooked a lot now as the kind of the business, the number of venues contracts, particularly in these major dirt jurisdictions, New York, California, Maryland, Florida. You used to, in all of them, have at least three venues that they could bounce between, and I think it refreshed the brains of the bettors, but it also gave a refresh to the track surfaces, and you mentioned it. We're seeing it down at Gulfstream, and there's the potential now over at Laurel, and certainly seeing it out in California. That somehow has to be solved. You know, how does it turf course rebound if it's getting used 9 or maybe 12 months a year? How does the betting public stay fresh in those kind of situations? So that's something that has to be addressed in these. You know, it's just an economic thing that's happening, but there are some side issues that have to be thought about.
Well, whether it's taking some breaks in between too, I mean that could be of use. I mean, that's one of the, you know, the unique elements in New York, that you get to move interchangeably between the three, you know, the three tracks. And frankly, it's healthy for the bettors too. And for, you know, the wagering public, you get a change of configurations, and you get, you know, a new start almost. I mean, when you've got one venue and you're running there nonstop, it just, you know, your eyes begin to cloud over. You just get, you know, there used to be natural ebbs and flows in the meet, and then you change. That's one of the reasons that the boutique meets are popular. You know, that stop and fresh start goes a long way. Let's get a view of this. I mean, we're not going to have a field until 5 o'clock tonight, Seth, to, you know, look at, but an 8-horse field, post positions aren't going to make a mammoth difference. And as we saw from Baffert with American Pharoah, if he should draw the one hole, we know what's going to happen mostly anyway with Mike Smith and Justify. But your thoughts going into Saturday?
It's just, it always is historically hard to get past the Derby runners, and so they're the most talented. You know, Justify, Good Magic certainly are legitimate here, and again, it's going to be tough to get by him if you look for a clever horse. And I've had the, you know, the PPs for the contenders for the last few days, and I just can't really find anybody to hang my hat on with much confidence. A horse I have liked, however, going back to the Heff in December. At Laurel was Diamond King. Came out of that, ran the third in the Swale, and then followed up winning the Federico Tessio. They were entered in the Peter Pan last week and skipped that to head to the Preakness. I guess that's the one that I would go on as maybe a clever thought. I think he'll probably have to step it up a little bit, and the two Derby runners certainly will have to come back. But, you know, just to take a shot, I'll probably play around with them a little bit. But I just think Justify and or Good Magic are probably the horses you're going to have to go through at the Preakness. And, you know, I kind of root for Justify just because I think it's great for the sport to have a Triple Crown going into the Belmont Stakes. So that'll be my rooting interest. But as far as betting, as they say, you know, on picks and whatnot, I'll probably put a little Diamond King in there just to see what can happen.
Well, we've had the financial aspect, the bankroll management, and just got a minute, Seth, but you and I have talked about this over the years, and you're a bet small, win big approach generally, particularly in the multi-race wagers, but this kind of a field, this begs for people to reach in their pocket and maybe not bet more, but bet bigger increments, and that can be hard for people. I keep reiterating this with all of our handicapping and betting conversations.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one thing where the Derby with the big field is so attractive to bet into and to pull the rubber band off the bankroll. I think a lot of times get pulled in because it's the next Triple Crown race and I'm going to jump into it. This may not be a great betting field. It may be a small field and a couple of horses may stand out. But certainly on the day, there will be those opportunities. And as I say, I'll have some picks that will have Diamond King in the mix. I'll give you an example. Last Saturday or Sunday at Woodbine, Dream It Is, the horse that came down and won the Schuylerville from Woodbine last year,
yeah,
just kind of laid over a field. But I took a shot with a couple of long shots to start a little pick three, and sure enough, Dream It Is beaten. And so for 20 cents, and they have 20 cent increment up there at Woodbine, a $20 horse beats Dream It Is. And so for 20 cents, it was a $90 pick three. And so that may be one of the ways to play in here. As I say, toss in a Diamond King or something, you know, just a little pick three, or something crazy happens, you could wind up with a price. Otherwise, boy, I think the Preakness may be tough to play with a lot of confidence as far as winding up with something decent as far as a payoff.
We will look for Seth's analysis at equidaily.com, and we'll recap it next week. Seth, thank you, buddy.
Good luck to everybody.
Seth Merrow, Capital OTB TV. We're going to send you out into the race day and want to wish just enough hope. Right now they're on the grass as long as the rain doesn't add any more in New York. So we're going to get her season started. And Pablo Fragoso taking over for Jose Lascano, who is concussed, speaking of concussion protocols. So safe trip to Pablo and hope in the sixth today. Thank Gary. Tomorrow, we've got Carlisle Bell in tomorrow, too. So a couple of days of some DT action. Thank Tony Montanino, our partner, and tomorrow Ed Kelly, too. So, and Gary, of course. Lots of good racing today. At draw 5 o'clock, XBTV. So watch, tune in, see how the field comes together. Belmont and Delta, Evangeline, Finger Lakes, Indiana, Louisiana, Mountaineer, Presque Isle, Thistledown, Woodbine. Want to thank Alan Foreman, Edgar Prado, Seth, Pete Fornatel, and and Sid Fernando. Good luck, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BrizNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BrizNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BrizNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year, and is available at BrizNet.com/APR. The BrizNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BrizNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BrizNet.com is the handicapper's edge.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
He's got a long way to go to come and get Army Mule, who's pulling away by 5.
2 years ago, Pennsylvania bred Army Mule was purchased at the Fasig Tipton Mid-Atlantic sale at Timonium. Now he's a Grade 1 winner.
Army Mule, ultra impressive in the Carter. He flew home.
There'll be more than 30 Pennsylvania breds at the Fasig Tipton 2-year-olds in training sale, May 21st and 22nd at Timonium, Maryland. Breeding and racing in Pennsylvania, it's a winner.
While being on the cutting edge of scientific and nutritional research, Biomedical Research Labs has developed the number one selling equine blood builder in the world, the most advanced muscle builder and tie-up preventer, and now the best anti-bleeding paste ever made. To find out how EPO Equine Unlock and Bleeder Guard can help your equine athletes, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880 and visit brlscience.com.
Porchbills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Porchbills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Porchbills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Porchbills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 938-4643.